originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, wherever you may be. Trainer Talk is on the air. Tonight's broadcast, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. This is Jude Feld, and I'm absolutely delighted to spend the next hour in our Jimmy John's of Lexington studio with you and our special guest. Tonight's trainer has an interesting story. She parlayed a very successful show horse career into a very successful training career. And as the Breeders' Cup likes to say, the best is yet to come. Our guest began training in October of 2010, and since then has had 254 starters, 37 wins, 32 seconds, 19 thirds, and $1.1 million in purses. In this year, 2018, she has 11 starts, 3 wins, and 2 seconds. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Michael Ann Ewing.
Thank you, Jude. It's nice to be here.
Nice of you to come into the studio. I told you you'd sound better if you came in. It's better than the phone. You don't have clients ringing in and all that stuff. So
That's true.
Happy to have you here. And let's start with the name, Michael. Does that create problems for you?
I was drafted. Now I'm dating myself. But I did get my draft notice. So obviously they don't go by sex. It must have been by name. Mm-hmm. And I was invited to join the Boy Scouts in whatever grade that is, fourth grade or whatever. But no, it doesn't give me problems. But sometimes if I call about something and I'll say my name is Michael Ewing, they'll say, no, honey, what's your name? Like I'm a dummy and I didn't give him my name. I'll say, that's my name. No, they'll say, you don't understand. What is your name? Not your husband's. I said, that is my name. So, but I like it. It's different.
Yeah, I like it too. Well, there's been a few. Michael Learned.
Right.
Talk about dating myself. Yeah.
Michael Learned.
Yeah. Aaron on the Waltons.
Right.
And, Michael Michelle is an actress nowadays.
Right.
She was in New Jack City, MacGyver, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And she's named for her mother's best friend, whose name is Michael. I thought that was interesting. Michael Sneed, who was a gossip columnist in Chicago. And Michael Steele, who was the bass player for the band The Bangles.
Well, you're up on more Michaels than I am. I thought it was original. Now it's old school hat.
Well, it's a great name, and I like it. But I thought as I was preparing for the show, and I had a couple people text me or call me and say, "Who's on Trainer Talk this week?" And I say Michael Ewing, and they go, "Who's he?" And well, I was wondering if it created problems for you.
No problems. It's funny. My assistant said, you know, they'll say, oh, I know Michael, or I work for Michael Ewing. And they'll say, oh, I know him. And she'll say, well, no, I guess you don't. obviously not. But I was born, my father was in the Navy and posted overseas when I was born. So he didn't see me for quite a while. And they went back and forth, he and my mother. But he wanted to name me Michael because I was the first of five. So he played football in college. He played for UCLA and in the Rose Bowl. So he thought having a family would mean somehow it would be all boys and they would all play football and he would field a football team. So of course what happened is he had four girls and one boy and we were all too small to play football.
And you went to USC.
I did.
He must not have been happy about that either.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't at all. And that was, you know, a little bit of a jab, I suppose, you know. Yeah.
You also went to University of California, Davis, right?
Yes, that was my first year, and then I transferred. I succumbed to my familiar pressure because they just couldn't understand why I was at Davis. They really, I was just different than the rest of my family. I was into horses from a really young age. No one in my family was, and my mother riding very early, starting in Pony Club. She thought I'd outgrow it and I'd grow up and be a cheerleader and, you know, do things that she understood. And so it was a really, I just took a different track. I was just a little bit different. So I went to UC Davis, of course, because like every girl that loves horses, you want to be a vet.
Right.
Or on the Olympic team, one or the other at the time. But then it was a big change for a girl who went to a girls' Catholic high school of 80 total kids. So there were 20 in my class. So at UC Davis, it was just so huge, and I was overwhelmed. So I transferred back home, became a business major, like, you know, sort of the family wanted. And USC was a little smaller than UCLA. So anyway, that's kind of how it happened.
That's how that worked. So what about the conversation when you told your dad you were going to USC?
It almost killed him. It almost killed him. And he just couldn't understand it. But he was supportive. He was, you know, but he didn't want to come on campus. He said, what if my friends see me? You know, he was a huge UCLA fan till the day he died. And probably of everything he did, that was the biggest deal, was playing football for UCLA. So that's where his head was at.
Yeah, in case any of our listeners don't know, that's one of the biggest rivalries in sports, and certainly probably the biggest rivalry in California,
yeah,
other than maybe the Dodgers and Giants, but
USC UCLA would be bigger,
especially in LA, in Southern California for sure. So that was very interesting. You started Pony Club at age 6, and how did that go? I mean, how long did you stay in, and what did you do in Pony Club?
We were going way back. We lived in Toluca Lake, California. And which is near sort of North Hollywood. And my neighbor got a horse. She was already in Pony Club. And I went out, and that was it. Because I always loved animals and horses, and I wanted to start. So my mother started me. They had a real Pony Club then with a British master. And there were ride nights, like Monday, Tuesday. You were the cubs, the hounds, the foxes, etc. And if you got good enough, you were invited to their Saturday morning jump class. And most of the kids didn't have their own horses. We rode school horses. And then you'd ride one evening a week. And you'd also have a lesson on horsemanship from the master. And then you would have to pass tests, written and riding tests, to pass up to the next night. So that I sort of progressed through that. And then, you know, as I got a little older, I was the girl that spent every waking moment in the barn, you know, braiding manes and tails for, you know, people that had their own horses that were going off to shows, or maybe walking them in the afternoon, or someone was gone on vacation, riding their horse for them, you know, to exercise it and take care of it. And I used to, before I could drive, I used to ride my bike from North Hollywood to the barn, which was over sort of in the area of Griffith Park. It used to take an hour. And this is the days, you know, when we used to walk to school barefoot through the snow. And I would just hang out all day at the barn, you know, with the horses. And we used to have these little, after our lessons, then we'd set up all the jumps in the arena, and we girls would just sort of trot around and jump. We'd have little horse shows, but with no horses.
Oh, you'd do it yourself.
Yeah, we'd jump over the fences, you know, and all that. So anything to be there. And then that progressed on and on. And when I was a little older, 17, I was fox hunting. And then I used to go and ride a lot of the thoroughbreds that some of these serious fox hunters had. They all belonged to this place in Los Angeles. And did that. And then I transitioned into Western and quarter horse, showing quarter horses. And that's what I did the last long time. Everything, paint horses and quarter horses, paints being at that time, not pintos, but quarter horses with too much white that were unregisterable for American Quarter Horse Association. And I showed there, you know, everything, Western Pleasure, trail, reining, and then I really got into the reining and did the reining for a long time.
And you won some championships too, I understand.
Yeah, and I had a lot of quarter horses that were halter horses, so we had quite a bit of reserve world champion halter horses, and which is all on confirmation. And we had weanlings, yearlings, two-year-olds, all that were world champions, reserve world champions. And I just rode. I love to ride. That's when I graduated from college. My first car, I bought a pickup truck, which you usually don't buy in California, Southern California, Los Angeles. And my first job out of college was working for Lloyd's Bank, which no longer exists. And I was in this bank training program on Wilshire Boulevard. And by then, I had my own horse or two, and I would I just worked as much as I could. Everything went for that. And I would leave on Friday afternoons and go to a horse show, say, in Reno, Nevada, drive all night, show horses in Reno, drive back to be back at work Monday. And I'd be driving down Wilshire Boulevard in my little banker suit, my little briefcase, with all this straw and hay just blowing out of the back of the truck.
Like the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, kind of.
That's cool. So. Well, in case you tuned in late, this is Jude Feld, and I'm visiting with trainer Michael Ann Ewing on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So when did racing come into your life?
Racing probably in the late 90s. Maybe it was just 2000. My husband and I were at Santa Anita in the director's room. He was there for some business event that someone invited him. And so they had Bob Hess Jr. there just to talk about horse racing and betting or something. And we got to talking, and my husband said, "You know, Michael, I've always wanted a racehorse." And I said, "Really? This was news to me." He said, "Yeah, my father and I used to go to the races when I was a kid," which tells you how much attention I pay to my husband, because I had no idea. He'd never mentioned this to me. And at the time, I had several reining horses and was showing, you know, all across the country. And so somehow it came about that Bob went to the Ocala two-year-old sale and bought us this little $20,000 two-year-old in training from the two-year-old in training sale. It was a bird on the wire. And so it arrived at Santa Anita, and I said, "Well, I have to go see this, you know." And I went out to the barn, and I was, you know, like the annoying owner that comes out and watched my horse train. And I was sort of horrified at the time because it was so different from what I knew. Because I remember when they legged the rider up, the colt, he was just a baby, and he reared up, and I thought, "Oh, my gosh, he has no manners." Anyway, but that was it. I was hooked in from day one, and I said, "Oh, I have to learn this, because there's no fun in just going to the races for me to watch a horse come across the wire first, dead last, or whatever it would be, but I have to figure this out and understand it." And I spent more and more time coming around. And pretty soon, I was so hooked, and I'd been showing all my life. It sort of took a backseat. And pretty soon, I'm selling my show horses, and I'm working for Bob. I'm there all day, every day. I'm walking horses just to figure it out and learn about it. Then I'm grooming horses. And years later, I'm kind of working as a foreman. Years later, I was an assistant trainer, and I would work with Bob and take his off-site barn, like at Hollywood Park when he was at Santa Anita. And I'd also bring the horses back to Keeneland. And then we'd maybe do Churchill. One year we did Monmouth Park. But so I was traveling a little bit. And that's where I fell in love with Lexington. But, you know, I was just hooked. And I would be there from sundown to sunup. There's just nothing else I wanted to do and nowhere else I really wanted to be.
Well, the mornings at Santa Anita are always spectacular, and just to be there is nice. And then, you know, with your interest, I could see where the sparks would start to fly, because there's a lot of beautiful animals that are housed there, and Bob always has a nice stable. So
Yeah, it's
a good place to hang out. It's beautiful, usually beautiful barn, very clean and sharp. And
Bob's barn was always He was very. He was a Wayne Lucas admirer. The way Wayne ran the barn in terms of everything being clean and organized and
right. Wayne changed the face of barns when he came over from the quarter horses. I mean, he had them come in and sod the ground and put in the white lawn chairs and the beautiful signs and the mottos, and everything was just perfect. And I remember that I was just starting to train then, and he shows up and everybody's going, what are we going to do? You know? And all of a sudden trainers started planting flowers and grass, and it was very good for the barn area. It made everybody's barn look a little bit nicer. Even if the trainers didn't plant anything, they certainly, raked in a herringbone pattern and
No, that's so true. So true. And true still to this day. I know we always try and turn out our barn as nice as can be, also because I'm anally retentive, but I like it to look nice. I want it to be a reflection of the way we take care of the horses. And that's important to me. You won't see my horses ever going to the track dirty, right, or, with poultice on their legs or...
Oh, yeah, that's a pet peeve.
Yeah, the way your horses look is a reflection of you, and the way I think, anyway, and the way your barn is kept and the cleanliness and the attention you pay to the horses, I think, is really important. And, I still to this day, I do it because I love it. I don't have to make my living at it. I mean, I could be doing a lot of other things. I'm fortunate that way. But I can't imagine doing something else. And it's interesting. I love horses, but I wouldn't have a horse if I wasn't competing. So it's that love of sport, but it's sort of like that love of taking something and developing it and making it the best it can be. So although I would always love horses, I have no interest in just getting on a horse and riding around. Never have. Mm-hmm. It's always a goal. And, racing for me is that. And obviously it's always about the wins. The wins are so important. But for me, too, I take a lot of pride in just making a horse be the best it can be, whatever level that might be.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot on this show. And one of the questions I like to ask trainers, which I had scheduled for later in this interview, but since you brought it up, we'll talk about it now. Is there a horse that you trained that you did just a superb job with? Because a lot of times trainers come on and everybody talks about their stakes horses and the good horses they have. But I always like to ask him, what's the horse that you trained that at the end of the day, you did something with this horse that maybe another trainer couldn't do, or you found the key or the best part of that horse?
Well, that's an interesting question because I don't have big stakes winners in my barn. I've not been fortunate enough to yet. But I've had some nice horses, productive horses, and I would say, I don't know if I could name a particular one, because I would say, I would have to say there's numerous sort of, I get these really nervous fillies a lot of time, and we're really patient. If you want to rush, I'm not really the person. We're very patient. I try and figure out, for me, every horse is different. That's the real interesting thing. They don't get trained all the same. They don't get handled all the same. Some are really calm, and others just have they're just nervous. Whatever makes them go off, I don't know. But, some will always use the pony with. Some will go early. I like to stand those really nervous fillies and take your time, kind of slow them back down. They get out in the afternoons or they'll graze. And we have the nice thing, what I love about Lexington and where I am, and I don't move around a lot. Like I don't go to Churchill or, Ellis Park. We have a barn right now at Keeneland, but most of our stock is at the Thoroughbred Center on Paris Pike. But because I have paddocks, grass paddocks that I lease, So the racehorses go out, which is really nice for their minds. And, you know, instead of walking for 3 days, a horse will go out. You know, they'll come in at night, but they'll go out for several hours a day. And all the other horses, they kind of rotate out and get a little time out during the week. But so there's little horses. Like I remember All Aces we had. She was a productive. She was a stakes placed. And she was just a nervous little filly that used to, you know, just kind of misbehave on the track. And we just took our time, always keeping at it. And she just turned out to be so professional. You take her to the races, and where we are, we jump up in the trailer to run over at Keeneland or run over at Churchill or run at Ellis Park or we've run at Presque Isle or wherever it may be. And, she, you know, they just end up turning out to be so professional. So I would have to say that's kind of numerous. I would say that's sort of my bailiwick, is taking the young horses that come from the farm, because I love the babies, and watching them develop.
Is that how you get most of your horses from farms, or do you go to sales? Or
I'd love to be going to the sales, but I don't really have those clients that buy them. I have mostly clients who have homebreds, and so they send their horses to the farm, and then they come into me, and then we take them from there. And a lot of them, they have their homebreds. They want they're all hoping for the best. You know, they're all hoping for a big horse, and they're all hoping that their horse will do well enough to help their mare. So they're not generally horses that they're horses they want to give more opportunity and time to and chances to, rather than just come out, even if I think it might be a maiden 30, but they want to run it maiden special and give it a few chances, see if it'll develop and what it might be. So it's kind of funny when you talk about numbers and percentages, which a lot of people look at. But I really don't pay attention to them, because there's a lot of reasons we run a horse where we run a horse. It's not always the first out where I think they're best capable of winning. And when you have homebreds and people want to make their mares, or just owners that have one horse or two horses, most of them, they don't want to lose them right away, and they want to give them an opportunity. And so sometimes you have to find out, is it dirt? Is it grass? Is it short? Is it long? You don't always know the first time out.
Yeah, it may take 3 or 4 starts before you even get a grasp, or the horse gets a grasp. I mean, you see horses all the time that their first race is horrible, and you go, well, maybe this one can't run. And then the next time out, they put them on the turf, and they run lights out, and, you know, or at least improve, you know, 10, 15 lengths. And well, so maybe it's the turf, or maybe it's the experience. You still don't know.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they just mature. Some horses need maturity.
Yeah.
And so that's most of my barn would be, I would say, homebreds or people with one or two. That's most of it.
And that's important for those type of people to find someone like you that has the patience and the time and the willingness to take care of those horses and try to develop them into something. So many times when an owner's looking for a trainer, they open the racing form or the program and say, oh, you know, this person's winning a lot of races, and they go there. And then a horse like that is going to get lost in the shuffle, because if it doesn't fire first time out, everybody loses interest in it. And, you know, they're looking to drop it and stuff. It may be an okay horse if somebody like you had it and could spend some time with it and figure it out and develop it.
Well, I think you can help make it the best it can be. But what that is, you know, it may be just a productive racehorse. It may not be. And I haven't had yet those big stake winners. So I'm still hoping, because that's what it's all about.
Well, you'll get there eventually. You're way too good of a trainer not to get some stakes horses. But yeah, it's hard. I trained for a lot of California breeders, and you know, my problem was I got too many of them to the races. I got all the horses to the races. We could get them to the starting gate, but whether they were good or not was a whole nother kettle of fish. But it's a tough racket. And And breeders, they don't like to give up on their horses. I mean, they've had them way too long. You know, when you start out when they're born, and you it takes you 2 years just to get them to the point where they can train. So it's a long road, and most people aren't really ready to cut them loose right away.
Well, that's really true. And so I'm really lucky, though. My clients, I have very good clients, and they love their horses. So they do want to give them every opportunity. And they're always concerned very much about their care. So that's what they're, I think, they find with me. So
yeah. Well, how do you get the word out about that?
Well, I don't get it out very well, apparently. Because, you know, to be really successful, and I would like to have, I would just like to have a full barn all the time, sort of, and win some nice races. And of course, I'd love the stake horses, but I find something in all my horses that I really like or I love, and their personalities. So, but I don't, so I wouldn't want to be really big because I do it because I love it. I don't want to be a CEO.
Yeah.
You know, I want to have my hands on the horses and know every horse. So I, you know, so, but I would like to keep it my barn sort of filled. That would be nice because I don't like to hire and fire people. And, you know, I'm concerned always they have families and I have good staff. So we kind of, sometimes if the barn sucks down to a smaller size, we just kind of keep people on and they're walking the shed.
Yeah. Well, that was the same problem I had. I never had a lot of horses, but I was usually like a dozen to 14. So, you know, but if you got down, I always kept my
people. You try to, yeah, because, as best you can.
You know, first of all, they're hard to replace. If they're good and you like them and they show up to work every day, you know, that's what you need. So you don't want to cut them loose just because you're down on a horse for a few days. You can always find another horse, but you can't always find a really good groom. So
it's this is where I go with the Hillary Clinton saying, which was what takes a village. That's what I think a barn is. It takes a village. Myself, my assistant, who's fabulous. Every rider, I think good riders are really important because they can give you a lot of feedback. You can see a lot, but a good rider will feel something that you can't see. And I say that because I was a rider. And then our grooms, you know, hot walkers. So I'm really lucky. My staff's been with me, most of them, quite a long time. And it's really hard now to find help.
Yeah.
Really hard.
Yeah, especially with the current political climate.
Yes.
This is Jude Feld, and you're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And we'll be back after we pay some bills with trainer Michael Ann Ewing.
Selected sales, superior results. Nominate now to Fasic Tipton's selected yearling sales, which are stronger than ever. The July sale for precocious athletic yearlings, the prestigious Saratoga sale, where leading buyers have searched for their next champion or classic winner for nearly 100 years, and the New York bred sale, which offers the cream of the New York bred crop. Learn more and nominate at FasicNoms.com. Fasic Tipton selected yearling sales, stronger than ever.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
A leader in turf racing across North America, Woodbine, one of the world's most dynamic gaming, racing, and entertainment companies, returns for championship thoroughbred horse racing in April. Committed to racing excellence and innovation, Woodbine is proud to offer the Graded Stakes Bonus Program for the 2018 racing season, allowing horsemen and women alike more opportunities to race against the best of the best. Woodbine continually strives to bring the most competitive and high-quality fields to the horse racing community and to its fans, and with this offer, now is your chance to race with champions. Owners, trainers, and horses come for the action and excitement. They come for the finest in hospitality treatment and dining. They come for the competitive purses. They come to Woodbine, the Northern Gem, transcending the sport of racing today for tomorrow. To learn more about the Graded Stakes Competition Bonus, call the Woodbine Race Office today.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And now Kles Z is moving in nicely from third. Green Cap, Kles Z going to come to the outside to take them on. Four lengths back comes Robbie's War. They come to the top of the lane. Tis Now or Then, Circle the Moon, running a big one in the white blinkers. Kles Z, Green Cap on the outside, four back to Robbie's War. They come for home, Circle the Moon, the leader, but Kles Z is now catching down the center of the track. 50 to go, Kles Z, Circle the Moon, Kles Z inching to the lead as they run down to the wire, and Kles Z will win it. Kles Z and Rafael Bejarano win it from Circle the Moon. Running on late was Power Foot.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld with our special guest, trainer Michael Ann Ewing. I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio on iTunes. That was a good race, huh?
Fabulous.
Big Purse, Santa Anita, Trevor Denman. You got like the coolest schedule a trainer could have. You go to Southern California in the wintertime, and then you come to Keeneland for
the rest of the year.
Keeneland to Keeneland, right?
Yeah. Well, Santa Anita, because that's home, and I know the condition book, and that's sort of home. I still have a home there, and the weather's better in the winter. And then we usually get back by March 15th. I really love training here, and we can go anywhere. We have a lovely barn at the Thoroughbred Center, which isn't so she-sy. Some people, you know, you say you train there and they want you on the track. But it's nice because we can go anywhere and train anywhere or run anywhere without being obligated to racing secretaries or getting that phone call, which is, well, you just took your horse off to run in Indiana, say. But, you know, you have to run your horse where there's a better race or a race that fits. So I don't get any of that grief, you know, being at the training center. So we stay there all year and then generally go to Santa Anita. Now this year we didn't, we stayed in Kentucky because I just thought I didn't have enough to that fit. And also because I go to Santa Anita, some of my clients don't want to go, so they just give their horses time off. It's interesting, at Santa Anita, the purses are very good, and you have some very tough trainers, but, you know, the fields are generally short. And you have tough trainers at Tampa and Gulfstream. Well, if you go to Tampa, which is lovely and great to train, and I did that one year, but you get all the way down there, and the purses aren't any better than up at Turfway, really. So, you know,
yeah, it's a shame
expense.
That the purses at Tampa are not better.
It is. It's a great racetrack.
Yeah. It's a good place to go. It's a good place to be and nice for the horses. And they seem to love that track. It's interesting to me, the disparaging. I have people blame it on the slot machines and all that stuff. I don't know if that's necessarily the case.
Well, I don't know. We went to Tampa one year. I think it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And I couldn't get stalls on the racetrack. So we had to stay at a training facility, training center, which was beautiful. And I loved it because it was a 20-minute walk through the trees to the track. So I love that kind of training where horses relax. I love that. And by the time they came back, they were cooled out, and we had great grass paddocks right behind the barn, great barn. But there was no facility for help to live on the track, so we had to rent all the help living facilities. So we did that, and then, of course, we had to rent all this. And, you know, it's a big expense, and you're not running for much money.
Right.
When I have a house sitting in California, you know, people can live on the track, and the purses are much better. So, and my family's there. So, so I guess you would say it. I just do it kind of the way I want to, and if it works, great. Mm-hmm. For my clients, you know, if they want to give their horses time off or something like that in the winter, which a lot of them like to do, that's fine. And then we had horses that this year that I thought would be turf horses, but they weren't allowance horses, so they wouldn't fit at Santa Anita because they really don't run claiming on the grass. So on the synthetic, I thought at Turfway that might work for them, and it did. And so it just worked this year, so we just stayed here. But after staying here this year, I think I'll be back at Santa Anita next year.
Yeah. Well, it's a nice luxury to be able to do that, to call your own shots, to be able to go where you want to go and kind of tailor make it for the horses. I mean, you can't take a bunch of horses out to Santa Anita and keep training and training and training and not have a place to run them, you know.
Makes no sense. Yeah. Makes no sense. And so, financially, even for my clients, for us to go all the way to Tampa and then run for that money, and they somehow in their minds, they think Tampa is reasonable because everyone goes from here. They go to Tampa or Gulfstream or Fairgrounds or maybe even Oaklawn. But by the time you go, say, to Tampa, they think of it as this big expense, and Santa Anita is even more of an expense to haul. Well, Santa Anita is a little bit more to go. It's maybe not quite double. But the purse money is four times what right. you get at Tampa. So I think it's a much better situation.
Yeah, you got a better shot of getting your money back
if you pay go for to your Santa ride. Anita. Yeah.
Plus they have
the ship-in now.
The ship-in bonus, yeah.
So. The ship-in bonus should cover the entire trip. That's what I think. But it helps.
Yeah. Well, any bit extra that you get can make a big difference, especially when you have a small barn. Because you don't have the big horses to overcome the
smaller purses.
So,
yeah, and that makes it tougher.
You know, Tampa's great too if you have a really nice turf horse and you're gonna run in some of the stakes, or you got a nice 3-year-old that you're gonna run through their, you know, Road to the Triple Crown program. Not all of us have that luxury.
Right. And it's a great track. And a lot of people, I think they go down to Tampa just to train and kind of keep their horses just going. But it's sort of so they're ready to come back for Keeneland and Churchill, and because it's such a nice track to train on or to race on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot of that.
Yeah. I used to, when I worked for Keeneland, I used to sit in my office, which was actually in the press box, overlooking the racetrack, and it would be snowing, and the Japanese U's that spell out Keeneland would be all covered in snow, and I'd look up and here's these guys walking around in shorts and Hawaiian shirts at Tampa, and I, what am I doing here?
That's so true. And this was a brutal winter, of course, the winter I stay here, and now I think we're looking at snow on Saturday for Keeneland.
I know,
and maybe next week. So
I just hate when that happens. I hate when they have to run, you know, really good races on off tracks and that kind of thing. It's going to be like that at Santa Anita too. Evidently, the Pineapple Express is coming in as a Californian. You know what that is.
Well, in California, you know, you get a quarter of an inch and the sky is falling.
Nobody can drive.
No. But it's interesting. But and that makes me, I think about this weekend at Keeneland. For instance, the stakes on the grass, will they run them on the grass? And if they do, it's certainly going to be really, I would think, pretty soft. But we'll see. I think we'll see how much rain we get between now and Friday, because it changes all the time.
Yeah, Friday's supposed to be okay, I guess, and then Saturday, not okay. But the Shaker Town's the only one that really is a concern for the stakes program. But I seriously doubt they'll run on the turf. But we'll see what happens. You have a husband, you have a son, talk about your family a little bit.
Well, my husband's has his own real estate company. It's property management and asset management. And he's my biggest fan, my biggest supporter. The first race I ever ran and won was at Keeneland. It was a $30,000 claimer, I can remember. And it was my first time, I think it was my first race at Keeneland. It was at maybe 2010 when I went on my own. And I came to Keeneland. And I think my husband was crying. He was so excited for me. So he's my biggest fan. So we've been married a long time, and he goes back and forth for his real estate business. But he spends more time here now with phone, fax, and email. He can do a lot of that, but he still goes back and forth quite a bit. And my son lives in California, and he's works with his father and helps run the business and so forth. So,
does he have interest in the horses?
My son?
Yeah.
No.
No.
They're all. No, he's a big supporter and fan.
He likes to go to the races when you run something, or
yes, yeah. He might, if it's convenient for him and I'm running something, he'll come out. But he rode a little bit as a kid, and he loves animals. But he's more, you know, into hiking on the weekends and that kind of stuff, fishing and jumping out of planes. And
he's an outdoorsman.
Yeah. He very much is. He very much is.
Yeah.
So, but he's very supportive too. And he loves to hear how we do and what's going on. And my family as well, they all follow it. And I think for my father, I used to, when I went on my own, that was a big deal for him because it would say my name up there. When I was assistant or it was my own horse, or he just didn't really follow it that much. And he was horrified when I started racing and started working at the racetrack. He was sure that by owning a racehorse or two, we would completely fall into heavy, like, bankruptcy-type gambling, and which I'm not even a gambler at all, so that's interesting. But I don't know where he got that from. I remember one time we were having lunch, and I was going back to the racetrack, and he said, he's very old school. He said, "You mean you're going unescorted?" He was just really, he just couldn't get over that. So, but once I started running in my own name, he would really watch all the races. And then he'd call me up. And because he had always thought he wanted to coach after he played football, and that didn't happen, he would tell me, "Well, geez, why don't you call those jockeys in and sit them down and, you know, do a, like a playboard and a
chalk talk."
Yeah. And, you know, coach. I said, it's just not really like that. But he would, and he would call and break down the races to me. And of course he had no background at all. No idea of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then in his older years, I'd call him up after a race and say, "Well, what'd you think of that?" He said, "Oh, that was terrible." I said, "Dad, I won." And he's watching the wrong horse or the wrong race, but he got a lot of pleasure out of it.
I ran a horse for Mr. House one time, and his sister flew on the private jet with him over to the races, and she said that to him. We won by, I don't know, well, 11, 12 lengths, and she said to him, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, the filly didn't run better." And Mr. House looked at him. And said, "She won. She totally missed our filly going to the lead and was looking back in the pack and thought we ran like third or fourth." So
it does happen.
People do miss the winners. But yeah, a lot of people don't realize, you know, when your name's on the program, it's public knowledge. You know, I remember one time I ran a favorite at Del Mar, and the owner's parents came out to watch the horse run because he called him and said, "Oh, the horse is probably going to win." You know, so we ran third that day. They were very upset. And, you know, were not saying nice things about me when I went down to talk to the jockey. And my friend Mike Roll was sitting in the box with them. And he says, "You're a stockbroker, aren't you?" And the guy said, "Yeah." He says, "You know, when you buy a bad stock, it's not in the paper the next day. But when Jude runs a horse and it runs bad, it's in there."
That's so true.
He stuck up for me.
So true. Well, it's always more pressure when, you know, I have friends that come and want to watch the races, or they come for the day. And somehow people that aren't in racing really think that you're going to win every time. And it's, they come out and they're there and you don't win. And then it's this silence, because what do you say? You know, just, it's just the way it is. But the pressure's always on too, because I, you know, I know my customers really want to win and they have great hopes for each horse. And they're not, you know, the big time syndicates, the, or the big time horse buyers that are really, they're looking for those big winners right away. And the other ones are, you know, they're not necessarily really interested in if they're going to be, you know, a claiming horse or an allowance horse. But for my clients, every horse is a big deal. And so I really feel the pressure when they don't run well, or they, you know, just don't perform like you think they will. And because I, you know, I just really, I suppose I'm empathetic. But, and also the first person I'm beating up always is myself. People don't realize you don't have to berate your trainer, because they always already feel bad, and right, you know, right, you know, when you don't do well.
Well, you've seen it from both sides of the coin, though. You've been an owner, you know what that's like, and now you're a trainer, so you know what that's like. So you're probably more empathetic than most. I think a lot of times trainers get a little bit on their high horse, you know, and yeah, this is my game, I know it, you know, and you should drop this horse, or, you know, we should run him here or there. And the owner has different ideas. How do you handle that with the clients? Do you educate them a little bit?
Well, you try to, you come to an agreement, you know, listen, I'm employed by them. So I work for them. I'm not the boss. They can take their horse and go anywhere they want any day of the week. And, but I hope they're coming to me because they respect me. So, but it's sort of like understanding where they're coming from. Is this an owner who wants to win at any cost? Run your horse where you think you can win first time out. Most people won't tell you that I work with, because they want to run them at Maiden Special, and they want to give them chances and find out where they fit. It's a communication, I would say. It's just a communication, and you have to understand where they're coming from. And sometimes, I mean, if someone asked me to do something that was not, like if they want to run their horse and the horse is absolutely not ready, or if the horse, they want me to do something that's not in a horse's best interest, that's just not going to happen. They could take their horse somewhere else. But I don't have clients like that. So I'm very fortunate I don't have anybody like that. But sometimes, you know, we were talking about trainer stats. Sometimes you run a horse, like say if you have a horse that you've been trying to run and it just has setbacks, not the kind that are anything really serious, but, you know, you get a horse ready to run, just about ready to go, and they develop baby shins. So you just have to back off. And then you get through that and you're just about ready to run, and maybe it's a filly and she ties up. So you back off and go through. Or maybe, you know, they get a respiratory infection or something. And some horses seem to tell you they just have these little issues. Or maybe it's a little injury and they go out for 2 months and then they come back in. And then you're ready to run and they get an abscess. Some horses just seem to have this, I'm almost there, no, I'm not going there. I'm almost there, I'm not going there. And so by the time you're three and you haven't had a start, and they're so close, and there's not the perfect race, and maybe you'd like to have a few more works in them, I say, you know what? It's time to fish or cut bait. We need to run this horse, because he's going to need an education anyway. And we'll get more from a race than we will from continuing to work this horse. So sometimes you're going to do that, because that's really in the horse's best interest. Put him in, let him learn something. He's maybe right, not where you think he's going to be. You know he's going to get tired. He's not going to get hurt, but he's going to get tired. So sometimes I'll do that. That's hard for me, because I really like to run a horse. He may run badly, but he won't run badly because he's not fit. But sometimes, you know, maybe they're short of works and it's time to go, because you get over that hump and then they move on.
Yeah, you want to get on a little bit different program than just train.
Yeah, so sometimes it's just really different, you know. And sometimes those horses that you start and you have a good foundation on and you have a little something where you have to send them out for 60 days, in the end it always turns out to be a good thing. They come back fitter, stronger. And when they have a little something that says, we've got to slow down and give me time off, that's usually telling you they're just, you know, a horse not ready. And they come back bigger, stronger, and you look back and you say, you know, I was impatient. I hated to give him that 60 days, but he needed it. But, wow, I'm really glad he had it.
Yeah, a lot of times, I see that a lot with two-year-olds, and it's one of my favorite handicapping angles with babies is if they, you know, they run a race or two, maybe pretty good, and then they're off for a while, maybe 3 months or four, and then they come back, like, in the fall. And man, they're so good then because they're savvy about racing and
much stronger.
Yeah. It's such a good thing to give them a little break. Even sometimes I think if I was training again, I would do it on purpose, you know?
Regardless,
just give them a couple starts. And if they didn't win or even if they won, because sometimes you win a race early with a baby and there's no place to run it except for stakes and you don't want to bang heads with the big boys yet, you know? So I think it's such a great thing for the horses to give them a little rest.
Yeah. And, or just a few months off, you know, a couple months, 6 weeks, even in the winter, just a little time down is always nice, especially for the young horses, I think.
Yeah.
But we don't do that so much anymore. A lot of places don't, especially, you know, like where you're on tracks and you don't really have that facility for a lot of farms. And I think when I was at Santa Anita, you just didn't see that too much, unless a horse was hurt. But you just didn't, generally, they didn't give them breaks.
Yeah, well, it's so hard at Santa. There's not very many farms anymore in California. It's very difficult to do that, to give horses breaks. And you mentioned the training center here in Lexington where you can turn your horses out in the afternoon and that kind of thing. And that's invaluable. I mean, that's why a lot of people pay big money to stable at Payson Park during Gulfstream, because there's so many different facilities available to them and the horses can be horses for a while and stuff like that. It's just, you know, it's irreplaceable.
Yeah. Well, that's what I love about the training center. Also, you know, I can gallop them on the grass instead of the track. Sometimes I think a horse needs a mental break, or you have a really tough horse and they'll gallop great in the field, but you can put them on the track and, you know, they're just galloping too, they want to gallop too strong. And also then, you know, it's just easy to dump them in the trailer and take them to, you know, the pool to swim or to the aqua tread or to the cold water spa. Or we just have so many facilities within 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I take advantage of all of those. In fact, I think all of our racehorses are like dogs. They love to go. They see the trailer and they jump in. So we have a long walk to the paddocks. And a lot of times when I'm going to turn out, I'll usually turn out in the morning and they'll get those that are going to go out after training if it's nice weather. And I'm still a California girl. I mean, if it's pouring rain, it's like, oh, no. And they'll go out and get a few hours out on the grass and they'll come in and then we'll turn some horses out in the afternoon. But they all haul very well. And in fact, knock on wood, I've had, because we do usually haul our own to the races, they all haul. People worry about it, but they haul very well, and they're very professional. I've been really fortunate in the saddling paddocks, and they just learn to do it.
Well, you see a lot of horses that are trained on the racetrack, and then, as you mentioned earlier, they go to other tracks to race, and the racing secretaries don't like that much. But when you're here, you have so many different condition books available to you. You see the jockey agents walking around. They've got, you know, 10 books on their iPad now. In the old days, they used to carry them around like they were in college. but now everybody's got them on their iPad and they're constantly looking for the best spot. And, you know, it's kind of a good situation for you that you don't have to hear that. You know, at Keeneland, it's not such a big deal because you're only here for 3 weeks at a time.
Right.
But, you know, you go to Churchill or you go other tracks and they get very provincial. I mean, it's a big deal up in Canada. Woodbine's always seem to be feuding with Fort Erie, you know, and I think it's kind of short-sighted for the racetracks to get into that, but I understand it.
Yeah, I do too. I understand it, but then I have to do what's best for me and my horses. So it is an advantage because, you know, Indiana runs the same time at Churchill. And so, you know, you have both of those, which are very close options. Yeah. So that's great.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, let's talk a minute. We're running out of time here, but I want to talk to you about Imperative a little bit, because Bob Hess was very complimentary of you and how you took care of Imperative before he won the Charlestown Classic, which is a race I'll be going to again. I think this is like 7 years in a row now that we cover the Charlestown Classic. So talk about Bob sending you Imperative because of the racetrack, the training track at Keeneland being Pauly, and what you did with him to get him ready last year.
Well, Bob sent him to me because he thought he would do better back here because, you know, he just didn't have the greatest feet. And, you know, the track out at Santa Anita's, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, you could gallop them on the 74 here, or the 405 at California. But, and it's just a quieter environment, not being on, you know, at Santa Anita, not being on the racetrack. So I think Imperative was pretty happy here. And he spent time jogging in the field some, you know, down on the training track where it's really quiet. And he trained very well, and talk about a horse with personality. And I just took a lot of pride in, you know, Bob gave me all the scoop on him and so forth, and I would say it was a collaborative effort, and Bob was very nice to send him back to me. You know, that was a compliment. And he ran just bang out race. Of course, he loves that track.
He really loves that track.
Yeah. And so he did really well training back here, very well.
Yeah.
And so I took a lot of pleasure in that, just seeing that he went out and won.
Did you go to the race?
No, I didn't go to the race. I sat back in my hole. And But Bob had him quite a while and trained him. And, of course, and then he had taken him to Gulfstream, and they'd won the, I want to say Poseidon, but. I'm having a mental breakdown.
I can't remember the racing.
It was the same, yeah. But that's not it. Anyway, and then I think they took him back, and he ran in the Santa Anita Handicap, and then came on back here. So
yeah, well, that was cool. I was excited to see that Charlestown Classic is a race we look forward to doing on the radio every year. It's a lot of fun to go to Charlestown and see everybody, and of course, Imperative is. He's kind of the king down there.
Well, he's won it quite a few times. Let's see. Or, yeah.
Twice.
And then he's done well. I'm glad they're going to have that race again, because I know they were talking about cutting the purse.
Yeah, that was touch and go for a while, but they finally came to their senses. That was a good thing. Well, this hour has absolutely flown by. Can you believe it, that we've been talking for an hour?
You say that to everybody.
I mean,
but I'll take it as a compliment.
It goes fast. It's crazy. Well, you know, like we've talked to Bill Mott, you know, came on the show, and I can't talk about myself for an hour, you know, 20 minutes, maybe that's all, you know, we didn't even get to Cigar.
Well, he would have a lot more to talk about than I would.
He's got a lot of stories, but yeah, he was great. And trainers don't realize it. So, well, thanks to Michael Ann Ewing for taking the time to hang out with us this evening. And a special thank you to our cracking producer, Lee Delapina, for keeping us in line and on time. I want to remind everyone to tune in to the Equine Forum, the show that launched the network, this and every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. on Sirius 219 XM 201 and streaming live on our website, horseracingradio.net. This is Jude Feld from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studios. Good night, everybody.